Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 161 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Dr. Becky O'Brien of Film Music Central. Welcome to the show, Becky.
Hello. I'm glad I could be here.
Yeah. I've been waiting all season to get you on this show because I've talked so much about the music, and finally I have someone who knows a little bit about music instead of me, who's just, you know, talking out of my rear end the whole time. So hopefully you'll actually have interesting things to say that won't contradict too much what I've said, but who knows? Maybe they will. We'll find out along the way.
No promises.
Okay, that's fine. Give it your all. That's what you need to do. Episode 161 begins with Creason continuing to speak and goes all the way till Mac gives a rousing speech. As we discussed on Friday, basically what has happened is Bartlett has finally been caught, and he's been brought into the Gestapo headquarters or wherever they're doing their interrogations. And basically, Creason is quite pleased that they finally have captured him. This is someone that he's wanted to catch throughout the entire movie. I mean, he was with Kuhn beforehand, but Kuhn actually was killed by Ashley Pitt a few weeks ago. So now we only have one of the two Gestapo men who brought Bartlett into the camp at the beginning, dealing with things. And he is very happy.
Is that the one on the phone?
No, the one on the phone is Dietrich. Sorry, Lieutenant Dietrich. We also have the SS officer Steinach, who's standing behind. He's the one who actually brings Bartlett in. I don't know if you recognize the actor who plays him, Carl Otto Alberti. Have you seen him before in anything?
He looks familiar, but I don't know where I've seen him.
So he played the main German tank commander in Kelly's Heroes, who ended up splitting the money with them in the end. Spoiler alert to anyone who hasn't seen it yet. He was also in Battle of the Bulge, but he had a smaller part there.
I'll have to go back to watch. But yeah, he did look familiar to me.
Yes. So basically, Creason begins by starting this minute by saying, Herr Bartlett and Herr McDonald. At this point, basically, Roger gets to finally look over and sees that Mac is with him also. You know, they split up last week when they were trying to get away from the various soldiers who were trying to capture them. But now he knows that he's also been caught. You know, he might have hoped that Mac somehow got away, but apparently not. You know, I like the little touches. You know, Mac's just sitting there on a bench, looking completely defeated because, you know, he's also a little maybe disappointed, maybe a little ashamed because, you know, he was actually caught. And, you know, both of them have handcuffs on.
It's not just how he was, it's how he was caught that he should be ashamed of, because it's the oldest trick in the book and he fell for it.
Especially since he was, you know, we had him a few months ago actually say something to Haynes about that he's got to be careful not to get caught up by that. And he himself gets caught up by it, but you know, that's some of the nice parts of the script. You know, they're able to go back on other things. I mean, one of the things I love about this movie is it's basically, and this is something that Sturgis mentions in his commentary to this movie that was on the Laserdisc and also appears on the Criterion Collection, you know, years after he already passed. But one of the things he mentions is the fact that so many people wanted him to cut down the movie, and he couldn't because the way that the story is built up, it's built on so many building blocks that if you pull one of them out, everything just falls apart because you need all the different pieces to this puzzle. That's one of them. What can you do? You know, the connections between the conversations, between the characters, you know, even, you know, the fact that Mac said something, you know, days before to someone and he fell for it himself. So, you know, that's another good example.
Exactly. I mean, this whole movie is full of counterpoints like that. And this moment is one of my favorites, but I don't think, you haven't gotten to the line he said yet that reminds me of it.
So Creason then says, "We are together again. You're going to wish you had never put us to so much trouble."
Yeah.
Is that the line?
That's the line, because it reminds me, I think it's meant to also remind you of the threat he makes to Roger at his introduction scene. I think it was actually Kuhn who says it in the beginning, says, as a reminder, if he escapes one more time and gets caught, he'll be shot. And so I'm pretty sure, what's his name? You said Creason?
Right.
And so Creason, you know, saying, you know, you're going to wish you'd never done this is like, a reminder they're going to follow through on this threat in case anyone had any doubts that they would.
Yeah, I mean, as we know, unfortunately, they take that threat a little further than they were suggesting at the time.
Because it's not just Roger who escaped. It was a bunch of others.
Yes, right. I mean, anyone who knows the real story knows that in the end, it was Hitler himself who made the decision to do this, which is just amazing that it reached such high levels.
I read the book that all this was adapted from, and what I read said actually when Hitler found out, he wanted them all shot, not just 50. He wanted all of his escapees shot, and his officers had to talk him down from it because, you know, they were thinking, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot, we would have done the same thing. So they finally talked him down to 50 to be shot, and that's how it happened.
Right. Well, actually, I just looked again to see who says it, and it's actually, what did I say his name was? Krieger. He's the one who says it. It's not either of the two that we thought. Dietrich. I don't know why I keep calling him Krieger. Okay, Dietrich. Dietrich is actually the one who says that if he once more falls into our hands, he will not be so lucky. That's what he said.
No, there's someone, but there's a line after that where he explicitly says you will be shot if you escape once more and are caught. So there's two lines.
That is very possible.
No, I remember. It's the very last thing the Gestapo person says to Roger before they leave. I've never learned their separate names, so I don't know who says it, but I know they said it.
Right. Kuhn says it. You're right. He says, if you escape again and be caught, you will be shot. There you go. Okay. So Kuhn says it, which is somewhat ironic that he's the one who says it and he's the one who gets shot.
Probably intentional.
I mean, again, they have a lot of great connections throughout the whole movie. So there's no question about the fact that it is very possible that this is what was planned by Sturgis when he put it all together. Basically, what's funny is that the way that he says the line, you know, you're going to wish you'd never put us in so much trouble, it also reminds us of the fact that this was Roger's plan all along. You know, his plan is hopefully we're going to get a few people to escape, but the idea more is to tie up as many of the Germans as possible. And, I mean, as we've seen, they've done that. You know, even when you have the scene where McQueen is trying to jump over the fence, I've counted, I think, over 50 guards that were there. So 50 on one, that's just amazing.
That's amazing, you know, that you counted, like, because it's true, like, at the very end, there's, like, swarms of Germans after him at the very last moment, like, and I didn't realize it was so many, though.
Yes, there's I think, 28 coming from one side, and 30-something coming from the other side, if I remember correctly. I discussed this a few weeks ago, so I'd have to go back to my notes to see the exact numbers, but I did figure it out, because it was, I mean, that's what you do when you go through a movie minute by minute. You need to find all these little interesting tidbits along the way. You know, things that people don't notice when they're first watching it, or when they've watched it 50 times or whatever, unless they've done it at this type of speed, because there's always what to find. You know, and I mean, even if you just look around at the core of this room, you know, look at the lighting. It looks like they're in some sort of castle, you know, some old-time castle or something like that. You know, the way that the doors are. And there's like a chest that's carved in a very strange way. I mean, this looks like antiques.
It is Germany in the 40s, so it very easily could be a castle, too.
Yeah, of course.
Although with the low ceiling, I always thought more of a castle dungeon, more specifically. Because it is the Gestapo, after all.
Okay, it could be that it is a dungeon because of the fact that outside of this room, they theoretically are keeping the prisoners. So they apparently have one large room in the dungeon and a whole bunch of smaller rooms. That is very possible. So basically, the Priesten is, as I've said numerous times today, he's very pleased with himself. He knows that he's done this right. He's finally captured the ringleader. Even though they never explicitly, they said, you know, at the beginning when they brought him in, they said that they have reason to believe that he's the ringleader. But they never were able to prove it then, and they're not able to prove it now
either. That's true. They never do. At least they never say it out loud that they know. But I have a strong feeling that with this last escape, they may have finally figured it out, but they just never said so. I've learned that just because something isn't said doesn't mean it's not believed by the characters, so
Correct. I mean, that's important. The fact that you know, they can't tell us everything. There's certain things that characters know that we aren't privy to, and it's based on their opinions. You know, it's just, I guess it wasn't important enough for them to try and prove it, which is fine. We know the truth. Even if Preston doesn't know the truth, we do.
Although that could explain why he's so pleased with himself, because he knows he's finally confirmed this is the ringleader and he's got him.
Or, on the other hand, he just doesn't like Bartlett for everything that has been going on, and he's happy that they're actually going to shoot Bartlett. Whether he's the ringleader or not, he's suspected of being the ringleader, so we'll get rid of him anyway. You know, could be. And I love the way that he's sitting there with his arms folded in front of him. You know, very, very pleased with himself. These, you know, the actor who plays him, Ulrich Beiger. Never heard of him before. Never seen him.
You'll always remember him for this. I mean, he's...
That's, you know...
Just... Oh, the way his voice comes across in this scene, it's so oily and evil.
Yes, and that's what they want. That's what they're... And then I love the way that you know, he has those buttons next to him, and instead of pushing one of them, he just puts his whole hand down on, you know, like, no whammy, press, you know, press
it's
your
like
luck.
He's like a king on a throne.
Well, he's sitting on a chair that looks like a throne.
True.
goes back to the antique structure of everything. At this point, he just presses on a bunch of buttons. Maybe he's just like trying to figure out whichever one works, you know. Because earlier he pressed on a button when Cavendish was in the room. He pressed on one button to call someone to come into the room and take Cavendish out. But here he puts his hand down and is pressing four or five buttons at the same time.
See, I never saw it that way. I always thought I could see like one of his middle fingers just reaching down to flick on one, and he just happened to lay his whole hand down, as sort of a grand gesture. And
that is possible.
And given how the scene transitions, I always saw him as like he's just pressing the button to set the next thing in motion. And
right. He puts his whole hand on there, and you see his palm pressing down. So it's not one finger that's pressing down. Maybe he's very precise and is able with his palm just to push one of the buttons. That is possible.
Or it so happened that the take was so good they didn't bother to shoot another one, even though
that could be
even though he's pressing down on multiples, and it wouldn't make sense with that kind of technology. But so sometimes a take is just so good they'll overlook that just because.
Well, they never expected that 59 years later people would be dissecting the movie minute by minute. So
well,
who would notice?
That is true, but here we are.
That is correct. Immediately after he presses the buttons, the scene changes, and we get to see an outdoor shot where it's early morning. You see the there's a little bit of light, not a lot of light, but you know, you can tell that it's somewhat near dawn.
Or is it evening? I've never been able to tell.
I believe it's dawn, because later on when we talk about it, you see like mist and stuff like that. It seems more as if the sun is coming up as opposed to going down. I've always assumed that, but I could be wrong. And at this point, we get a very interesting rendition of music here. So maybe you want to talk about the music.
I've been waiting, and ever since you invited me on to talk about this is why I wanted to pick this moment, because this scene, it took me dozens of rewatches to catch on to this, but with the music being what it is, this scene with the trucks in this minute is a literal bookend to the opening shot of the film. Now, in the opening shot of the film, the trucks, we have the happy, upbeat main theme of the film to take us along to the Stalag, but now we again have a shot of trucks, but it's this macabre funeral march, basically. We've got the heavy organ, the drum beat. They're the complete opposite of what we got at the opening in terms of...
But it's the same music, just different instruments? Is that what
Not so far as I can tell, no. This is... because remember, the main theme is... Da, 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 da. This is not that. Right. I mean, now I can't say for certain without looking at the score. It's entirely possible Bernstein has slowed it down and is using similar notes, but I really don't think so. This is more of just a couple long chords on an organ to set the tone of like something really bad is about to happen. I mean, plus the fact that it's it's darker outside. Heck, there's even storm clouds. There's even clouds in the, it's even a dark, cloudy sky even. Which is, again, to the opposite of the opening shot, which was blue sky, sunshine, there's hope. Total opposite here. It's cloudy, it's dark, we have a chilling organ music to send the trucks along. Something really bad is going to happen. And...
Wow. Wow, okay, that's great insight. I mean, I could hear it also in the music that it's somewhat, you know, tense music, but it's also somewhat, it sounded to me it still being some sort of a military march.
Well, yeah, and that's because of the drum beats and stuff, and that makes sense because, you know, I mean, they're all military men anyway. They're being taken away by the Gestapo and the military to be shot, so there's going to be that martial sound there too. But also, if you think about it, with the drum beats, where else do you hear drum beats like that in when a firing squad is getting ready to be set up? You know, think about that that martial set. I mean, granted, this isn't quite the same thing, but it's implied.
Okay. Oh, wow, that's great. I mean, I heard something that Bernstein thought of the original tune of the movie when he was 14 and was waiting for the right movie to be able to use it.
I had not read that, but I can definitely believe it. I mean, that's how brilliant composers can be sometimes. They'll come up with melodies, and all it needs is the right film to make it work.
Yeah.
And sometimes, funnily enough, you'll hear it more than once if it works for more than one film.
Yes, that's true. There are themes in this movie that sound similar to Ghostbusters.
My favorite is it's a side note, but in the opening of the theme, there's a bit that sounds like it comes right out of The Magnificent Seven.
Okay. Bernstein did that also, right?
Yeah, he did, which... Yeah. And in fact, I believe that was before this film, too.
Yes, so. It was. It was three years before.
So it would totally make sense that he might quote part of it if it happened to work.
Hmm, interesting.
But, lots of composers do that.
They do it in a subtle way that you won't always notice it. And if you're not a music expert, you're not necessarily going to notice it.
Well, that's true, but some are still, like the late James Horner, some were less subtle than others.
Okay, that's true. That's true.
Horner was purely guilty, but I digress.
I know you're a fan of Horner. I'm aware of that.
I am.
And I partake every year. in that indulgence of yours. So that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. Okay, so basically the scene continues. You know, we have the trucks rolling through the night. Again, we're not 100% sure if this is dusk or dawn. We'll maybe get to that soon. I like the procession. Basically, you have a staff car followed by a truck, motorcycle, truck, motorcycle, truck, motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that they didn't have at the very beginning. At the very beginning, when they showed them all, there wasn't something in between each of the trucks, you know, separating them. I mean, obviously, there's a reason why they have them, you know, they have a motorcycle set up for each of them here.
But in the opening, it was just, there was a car in front of the trucks.
Yes, but there wasn't something in between each of the trucks. There was a procession of trucks, one after the other. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
And then we get an internal shot of one of the trucks, and we get to see Roger and Mac and Haynes and Cavendish, who are basically the only four that we've seen captured in this whole movie, you know, that were shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Cavendish showed up a few weeks ago and he was put in the dungeon, so he bumped into Haynes. And now we have Roger and Mac. So we have the four of them sitting together. Mac and Roger begin to have a very interesting conversation, which is quite telling for the entire movie. I mean, this is... more or less the bookend of their whole story that will start today and continue into tomorrow. Basically, then Mac says, "What's troubling you, Roger?" And Roger responds, "I'm just a little surprised. I expected either a long stay or a short trip." So Mac then agrees with him, and then Roger says, "I have to admit, I'm a little worried, though. I hope to God I haven't blotted 70-odd ledgers." Now, you know, I found that very interesting that he says 70-odd. As opposed to saying the specific number of 76. Now, we know that 76 got out. Roger theoretically should also know, because they know the numbers, you know, the what number everyone was in the escape order, because they knew that, I guess, Cavendish was 76. He was the last one to get out.
How do we know Cavendish was 76?
How does who know?
Oh, that's...
Well...
I thought there was one more after.
No, there was. Griffiths got out, but then he got caught. So Griffiths was number 77.
That's right. I forgot.
Now, in the original script, it actually did say 76. He says, I hope they got, I haven't blotted 76 ledgers.
Why did they then? Does it say?
No, I don't have notes as to why things were changed, but my assumption is that it makes more sense for him to he doesn't need to be as precise. If he would be precise, people might ask the question, they might start wondering, how does he know specifically 76? We know that 76 got out. So it's possible that Roger, with his phenomenal memory and, his ability to put everything together, would have figured it out. But it sounds a little better for him just to say 70-odd, and that's it.
Is it also possible that he's hedging his bets because maybe he's counted up and realized they're not all there?
Well, he knows they're not all there.
So maybe he's hedging and thinking maybe at least a few got away.
Okay, that could be also. And then Mac has a very interesting speech that he gives here, responding to
Before he says that, though, there's one thing I want to say about what Roger says about hoping he hasn't blotted out the ledgers. I just find it, I've always found that a little ironic that he's worried about that now, after all he's done this. Like, I thought he'd made it clear that they had to do whatever was necessary to cause trouble, so surely he knew going in that this was a distinct possibility. So why is he worried about it now?
He's worried about it because he finally got caught, and he sees... 50 other people caught with him. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe beforehand, in the original script, I discussed this a few months ago, I guess, the whole fact there was a big argument between him and one of the other characters about what their main goal is here. I think it might have been with Hiltz. He said that he's willing to take the chance that a number of the prisoners are going to get caught and shot in order to fulfill what they're trying to do by opening up another front. So, the fact that he's worried about it now... It's because now it's become a reality, I think, as opposed to him just considering it. Beforehand, he didn't consider. Every one of the 76 who got out assumed that they were going to be able to make it to freedom. They all had their plans of how they're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, 73 of them didn't figure it out properly. But so when you look at it, so Roger had high hopes that he was going to be able to make it and everyone else was able to make it and as many as possible. But at this point, he sees how many were captured and, is wondering what's going to happen to them. So he's concerned at this point because it would be all on him,
Yep.
So then Matt gives his speech. I'm going to read the whole speech and then I'm going to go back because there's something I want to point out about that he says it. So he goes, no, we're all over 21, footloose and fancy free. We'd never have gotten as far as we did without you, Roger. For what it's worth, I think you did a damn good job. I think we all do. Obviously, this is complete fiction. Nobody knows what was really said between the two of them, or between the real Roger Bushell and whoever was with him at the time. We also know that in real life, they were shot in smaller groups, sometimes in pairs, sometimes one on their own, individually. Yep. I think there was a point where they shot four of them at once. I think that was like the most... Based on what I can remember.
Yeah, but the filmmakers were on record saying they did it this way because of the drama and such.
I like it this way. It makes it much, much... I mean, have you ever seen the pseudo-sequel to this movie? The Great Escape 2, The Untold Story?
No.
Okay, so that's a made-for-TV movie that came out in 1988 with Christopher Reeve, Judd Hirsch, and a few others. It's not as good as this movie, but it does stick more to the real story. It's also 3 hours long, so it's even longer than this movie. It's like 6 minutes longer, so take that into consideration before you watch it. But in that movie, they show it more accurately the way that they were shot in smaller groups.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the way they did it here for dramatic purposes. It feels even more sentimental the way that they do it here, where you just get a group of them shot all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Now the one thing I wanted to discuss was Mac's use of the phrase "footloose and fancy free."
Oh.
Because I was curious where that phrase comes from. I mean, this is something that you don't hear that often. Obviously, most of us have heard of the movie Footloose.
Yeah, but
and they don't mention the movie. They don't mention the phrase "fancy free."
Is it not accurate to the times?
No, it's actually very accurate. I looked it up to see what it means. It is accurate to the time, but it doesn't make as much sense when you hear what it means.
Okay.
So the definition that I found online was that what footloose and fancy free means is that it's for saying that the characters are not married or in a similar relationship, and you therefore consider them to have fewer responsibilities or commitments.
Well, see, that makes perfect sense to me. They chose people to escape that if they got caught and shot, it wouldn't affect families as much over back home.
No, first of all, that's not true. They were married men that were chosen also.
But I mean, in the context of the film.
In the context of the film, we never know. We don't know if any of these characters are married or not.
But
we know that Cavendish, they say to him, you know, you're never going to see your wife again. And he goes, you've got the wrong man. I'm not even married. Now, he could have been saying that truthfully, or it could have been just his way of trying to throw them off.
I guess I'm a very literal-minded person, so if I take what's said in the movie at face value, I mean, I don't know, maybe I don't understand it.
No, go ahead. Say what you want to say.
We're allowed to
disagree here.
I was just saying, it
adds to the drama.
I know in real life that a lot of the ones who were shot, of course there were married ones and not, but if we take it at face value in the film's version of reality, he's just trying to reassure Roger that, I always took it as saying, like, forget the definition. I always took it as him saying, we went into this with our eyes open.
Yeah, completely.
Don't beat yourself up for this. We all knew what we signed up for.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I just found it funny that that's the phrase that they chose to use. That's the thing, because it just, that what they're trying to say is, okay, we're, I mean, it's funny they say we're all over 21. You know, people were drafted at the age of 18. So that in and of itself, you know, is a little bit different. And also, if you look at the ages of some of these actors, I mean, Gordon Jackson was 40 when they made this, or 30, 39 when he made this.
Was that McDonald?
Yes.
Okay.
Gordon Jackson is McDonald. And Attenborough was of a similar age. Attenborough was born also in 1923, yes. They're both the same age, the two of them. McQueen was younger. McQueen was born in 1930. So he was only 32, 33 when they made this. Garner, a little older than McQueen, he was born in 28. So he was...
Donald Pleasence was in World War II, so that's what that tells
you. Yes, correct. You know, it's interesting just looking at the fact. I mean, Pleasence was born in 1919, so when they made this movie, he was 40, 42, 43, depending on when it was filmed.
Yeah, that's been a thing in Hollywood for years, though, of casting people who are technically not the correct age to be doing what they're doing, but...
Yeah, no, of course not.
When has that ever stopped them?
And that's basically how the minute ends. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Nope, that pretty much summed it all up.
All right, excellent. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, if you want to find me on my blog, Film Music Central can be found at www.filmmusiccentral.com. Or if you want to find me on YouTube, I also have a channel under Life as a Music Gamer. Music Gamer is one word. Or you want to find me on Twitter at MusicGamer460.
All right, excellent. We hope that you go and rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher they might be using to listen to this show. You can send us an email, thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. And our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. Becky, you want to come back in tomorrow?
Of course.
All right. So until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.